You are listening to a programme from BBC Radio 4.
Thank you. You're listening to the Westminster Hour in Glasgow, where the Liberal Democrats have been busy being critical of both the Conservatives and Labour, accusing Ed Miliband's party of burying its head in the sand over the deficit, and the Tories of wanting to cut the deficit by beating up on the poor. Nick Clegg's warned the party faithful, like those here in Glasgow, that they'll have to fight tooth and nail ahead of next year's vote, acknowledging that the party, which has seen poll ratings as low as 6%, faced the fight of their lives at the election. The mood here, then, stoic in the face of adversity. Stephen Tall writes the blog Lib Dem Voice.
I think if I use two words to sum up what Lib Dem members are feeling at the moment, it's fear. Absolutely fear. You know, we read the opinion polls like everyone else does, and we can see that our support is down by at least half since the last general election, and that would mean that we lose a lot of seats in next May's general election. But there is also resilience as well. That's the other word, resilience. That those MPs in particular who are really bedded in within their constituencies are not confident but hopeful that actually they can buck the national trend. I think this election has been billed as a survival election. I think we're all realistic about that. And the hope is that enough MPs can hold on to their seats to mean that the Lib Dems remain a viable fighting force after May 2015.
Much of the focus in speeches today, an attack on the future cuts to benefits and public services proposed by the Conservatives. Paddy Ashdown accused the Tories of planning a scorch-and-burn approach to welfare. The Business Secretary, Vince Cable, described the Chancellor's planned freeze of working-age benefits as excessive. In the conference hall, they voted for a review of some of the Coalition's key welfare changes. On Tuesday, they'll vote on whether to make ditching the bedroom tax or spare room subsidy a manifesto promise. The leadership should have stamped on the idea much earlier, though, says Linda Jack, who chairs the group Liberal Left.
I think it was such a mistake. To be honest, if they had thought it was the right thing to do, for example, if they thought it's more important to have the bedroom tax and then we will get something else in return, people premium, whatever it may be, then you could have explained it and you could have explained why we thought that it was a price worth paying. That is a perfect example of what I say happens when the leadership don't listen to the party, because the party's called it right on this and lots of other things like secret courts every single time, but the leadership seems to have got kind of almost swallowed up into the bubble of coalition government, and that means they don't actually see the reality outside and they make decisions without consulting the party.
Nick Clegg hopes to inspire potential voters with promises about what sort of impact his party could make in a future government, insisting that the well-off would have to pay more to deal with the deficit. Taxes would have to be increased, he said, and he confirmed that he'd ditched plans for a mansion tax in favour of new council tax bans on high-value homes. But is anyone listening anymore? Asks Naomi Smith, who chairs the Social Liberal Forum.
There is a huge problem of trust. Because of that, I fear that our conference has turned into a bit of an echo chamber. We're talking to ourselves. Is anyone really listening? Even when we start to say some of this excellent stuff and we start to set out our stall as distinctive from the other parties, the problem is the believability issue. We need to do an enormous amount of work on that. Thankfully, we've got individual MPs who are excellent, and when voters are asked to think about their individual MPs, actually some of those poll ratings do go up considerably. So it's really going to be about getting back into our communities, emphasising our individualism from the other parties and reconnecting back with our principles.
The last 4 years have cost the Lib Dems dear. Membership down, the voluntary party scythed. The party has its lowest number of councillors since 1983. But still, former Minister Jeremy Brown argues, it's wrong to act now like a surly opposition party disowning the coalition.
I think people recognise in their heart of hearts, not everybody, of course, but a majority of people, that the coalition has made a reasonable fist of dealing with some deep-seated problems that we've got as a country and starting to move things in the right direction. And I think the pitch that the coalition would deserve to have more time to carry on doing that good work would be a popular pitch, and we would win the majority of the seats. Now, of course, the coalition isn't on the ballot paper, and so the two parties in the coalition, the Liberal Democrats and the Conservatives, will be making distinctive pitches. But what the Liberal Democrats, in my view, should not do is distance themselves from the coalition that we have been a part of, because I think the coalition is a broadly popular winning proposition, and it would be a big strategic mistake of ours to allow the public to associate the Conservatives with the coalition and for us to create distance between ourselves and the government that we serve in.
The polls look dire, and some here would prefer a period out of office altogether to rebuild their activist base. If there are coalition talks, will it be Nick Clegg at the helm? A new red line seemed to emerge this morning from David Laws when he suggested that the Lib Dems wouldn't accept any coalition deal that required Nick Clegg to stand down as leader. Naomi Smith makes no secret of the fact that she wanted Mr. Clegg to go after the disastrous European elections. So how does she assess his current stock?
I think Nick's in a difficult position, having lost 91% of his European parliamentarians in May. I think if a chief executive's share price dropped 91%, or if the chief executive of a public sector organisation oversaw their key performance indicators falling by more than 90%, they would find it very difficult to stay in office. He is our leader. He's doing a good job at this conference. He's trying to rally the troops. But I do think the narrative seems to have changed within the party to not if he'll stay on as leader, but when he'll step aside. He will be our leader going into the general election, that's for sure, and what happens after then remains to be seen.
Speaking to two councillors from York, they were beaten, bruised, but showing some of the Dunkirk spirit all around us here in Glasgow.
I don't always believe what the polls tell me. They didn't get it right in the Scottish referendum campaign until right at the end. And the electorate will say what the electorate will say. And the things that affect that decision may be last-minute things and not things we can see now.
6% in the polls.
Well, we've been there before. You know, there's the old joke about you can tell the size of the Liberal Democrat Party by the size of a telephone box. But, you know, we're capable of higher and better things, and I think we will do this time. The British public recognise that Liberal Democrats have taken a responsible part in this coalition and that we've achieved a few things. Quite a lot of our manifesto has actually happened, and that's unusual for a second party in a coalition. So we think we've done quite well. We hope the British public recognises that too.
Saying cheerful, Lib Dem councillors from York. Well, Jo Swinson is the Minister for Employment, Women and Equalities. She's Lib Dem MP in East Dunbartonshire. I began by asking her about the party's struggle to persuade voters to give the Liberal Democrats some of the credit for the improvement in the economy.
I think increasingly, particularly now the economy indicators have started to improve, people have recognised that difficult decisions were made, but it was in the national interest, perhaps putting national interest over our party interest. And I think people are increasingly recognising that Liberal Democrats have played a constructive and vital role in this coalition government, in making sure we got our economy back on track, but crucially also made sure that was done in a fairer way. And last week's Conservative Party conference showed beyond doubt what a Conservative government on their own would have done, or indeed would want to do in the future, which would be about solving these issues by having cuts on the working age poor, hitting them hardest, firing people at will, the snoopers charter, schools run for profit. We've stopped all of that happening. That's what the Conservative agenda would be, and that's why Liberal Democrats have been so vital as part of this government.
And you are certainly bashing the Conservatives this weekend, but bashing the Conservatives last year didn't do you any good, did you? You had all those disastrous election results. So why are you doing it again?
Well, we are telling it like we see it in terms of the record that Liberal Democrats have in government, that we've managed to put in place large numbers of Lib Dem policies that have helped individuals out there in the country, whether that's cutting taxes for people who are low earners, that's in more free childcare to help families who've got hard-pressed budgets, increasing pensions. All of these things are making a real difference.
Yeah, but you're saying that you had to do it alongside a nasty group of people. That's the impression we're getting.
Which I think makes it all the more admirable what we've managed to achieve, because it has been an uphill struggle to get many of these policies through, given the coalition partners that we have and that their priorities in many cases has been so diametrically opposed to the fairness agenda that we're promoting.
But look, if they are so terrible, why then are you considering doing another deal with them after the election?
Look, Caroline, I'm a Democrat. I think it's up to the voters to decide what kind of government we want to have in this country. There will be a general election
next May.
There's
been open talk about coalition. I mean, yeah. But my point is, as a Democrat
and as a pluralist, I believe in having a range of different political parties that people can make the choice between, rather than having a very kind of narrow one-party state or two-party state. I don't think that's in the best interests of democracy. I think we're setting out very clearly what the differences are and what the Liberal Democrat proposals are. We've got our debate later this week about our pre-manifesto, which is a document which is full of Liberal ideas to take forward the things that we've done in government and how we can take them on to the next stage. That's what we're going to be putting to the people in the election next year. Now, obviously, after that election, if there is not a clear outright majority winner, then parties will need to look at how they can properly respect the wishes of the British electorate and, if necessary, negotiate a coalition that could be, therefore, in the country's interest going forward. And in any such negotiation, then each party will be trying to use the votes that they have been given to deliver the maximum number of those policies.
Would you do better without Nick Clegg? You heard Naomi Smith's point that he lost 91% of his parliamentarians in Europe in May. There is certainly a series of polls that suggest the Lib Dems feel they would do better without him. I mean, just quote one survey by Comrades for BBC One Sunday Politics suggested 27% of Lib Dem candidates for next May's general election regard Nick Clegg as an electoral asset. 27.
I don't believe that would be the case at all, that it would be better. Naomi is entitled to her view, but you even heard Naomi say that she thinks Nick's doing a good job at this conference and that he's going to continue as leader. Nick is absolutely the right person to do that. He has taken an incredibly difficult job of being Deputy Prime Minister, taking Liberal Democrats into government for the first time in the UK Parliament, and delivering a huge amount of our manifesto. You know, according to the UCL Constitution Unit, 75% of our manifesto ending up in the coalition agreement, which is a fantastic achievement for a minority partner in the coalition, and making that difference to people's lives through cutting taxes, improving things on childcare and pensions. The jobs in this country has been a great success story with more than a million new jobs in the private sector. So that's been a great set of achievements for Nick, doing a very difficult job and balancing act. And I think that taking us into the election, then Nick is absolutely the right person to do that.
After the election?
And to continue, absolutely. He has proven that he's able to lead our party in some of the most difficult circumstances that we've faced.
You are the Minister for Employment, but also for Women and Equalities. And I wondered, there's been a lot of question and doubt about your party's attitude to women under scrutiny, particularly after the Lord Renard allegations. Have significant improvements been made, do you think, to reassure people in your party who still have real concerns?
Well, I think that this is an issue across politics. Absolutely, as Liberal Democrats, we have been looking very carefully at what we can do better, although I think it wouldn't be accurate to suggest that this political culture is something which doesn't exist in other parties and indeed parts of the media and the Westminster bubble.
But in terms of candidates, you are far behind Labour, well, you are far behind the Conservatives even.
That's why I'm so glad that Helena Morrissey came in and she did a report about the culture and practices of our party. But rather than that report, you know, being left to gather dust, we've actually asked her to come back to do a year on review to see how that implementation has been going. We've got many of those things that have been suggested already in place through the pastoral care officer, through new guidance, new processes within the party. But do we need to do more, particularly in terms of improving our representation? Absolutely. I mean, it has been inspiring to see so many of our what we call leadership programme candidates, those candidates from underrepresented groups that have had specific support directed at them over the last few years. So many of them selected in winnable seats for us, particularly where we have, you know, MPs standing down like Lisa Smart in Hazel Grove. We've got Julie Perkson in Berwick-upon-Tweed, Leila Moran in Oxford West and Abingdon. I mean, we have got fantastic candidates in these seats with a really good chance of winning and becoming Lib Dem MPs. So I think that's very exciting. There's no room for complacency whatsoever, but I do think that there's also a lot of room for optimism.
And we know that Paddy Ashton, who used to be absolutely opposed to all women shortlists, now acknowledges it's something that should be considered, and other members of the leadership have said the same. Is it a view you share? Do you think that after the election that you could well adopt the idea of all women shortlists?
Well, these decisions, like others within our party, are ones for conference. As a democratic organisation, that's how we make these decisions. I mean, personally, I think that we need to look at where the problem is, and at the moment it is not in women getting selected in seats. But therefore, I think that the measures that we are taking are ones that should start to bear fruit and that should be continued, because this is something which is going to take, you know, time to get right and continue to focus on.
Jo Swinson. Well, listening to that, the political editor of the Financial Times, George Parker. And George, judging by most of today's comments, at least, the theme for this year is bash the Tories. And yet, I wonder if you find that underlying all of that, there's still a sense that, on balance, a coalition with the Conservatives would be preferable to many of the leading figures here.
Well, better the devil you know, you mean. And I think probably there are quite a few people at this conference who watched the Labour Party conference and Ed Miliband's speech in particular and thought, well, actually, we may not like some of what David Cameron's been saying recently, but would it be any easier working with Ed Miliband? And I think what you've seen here really is a party which has lost over half of its support. A lot of that's gone off to the Labour Party. So obviously it makes sense for the Liberal Democrats to define themselves against the Conservatives. And defining yourself against the Conservatives, if you're the Liberal Democrats, makes perfect sense on lots of levels. You can present yourself as the party that's greener than the Conservatives, that cares more about civil liberties than Conservatives, cares more about social justice than the Conservatives. So on a whole range of measures, it's an ideal way to define yourself. But behind the scenes, you speak to people, and you've heard actually Norman Lamb, the health minister, saying it publicly on the record, he doesn't consider Ed Miliband as a potential prime minister. And I think there are quite a few people at this conference who think that a deal with the Labour Party in a hung parliament would be just as dangerous, if potentially more so, than another deal with the Conservatives.
Yeah, Norman Lamb said it would be enormously damaging to be latched onto a Labour government with a low percentage of the vote. I mean, there are even people here, though, saying that perhaps the Lib Dems won't be in a position to be the kingmakers. You know, there could be other minor parties who come forward. They may not be able to be choosy.
Well, it's going to be a patchwork probably at the next election of parties. And here we are in Scotland, and we see the SNP, the bounce after the Scottish referendum. They've picked up something like 30,000 members, I think, as a result of that campaign, posing a real threat to the Labour Party in Scotland. So you can see the SNP picking up a whole range of seats. You could see UKIP picking up some seats. You could see the Liberal Democrats, even though they could lose a fairly substantial number of their seats, still getting 30, 35 seats, maybe 40 if you're optimistic and you're a Lib Dem. So a patchwork of parties. But still, I think the Liberal Democrats still think they can be in a position where they can hold the balance of power. And they think about what it would be like if they were to do a deal with Labour. Because if you're in coalition with the Labour Party, what are you? You are the party which has to hold Ed Miliband's feet to the fire when it comes to fiscal discipline. You're the party that says to Ed Miliband, you can't spend money on the health service. You can't spend money on childcare because you've got to worry about balancing the books. And how does that work with a centre-left party, which essentially the Liberal Democrats still are? How do they feel about being the nasty guys in a coalition with Labour? It's a problem because we often assume that a deal with Labour would be the easiest thing for the Lib Dems to do. I think,
and a lot of activists still talk about that. But
in
your point,
I think it would be the harder option. Yeah.
What about red lines, though? I mean, we've heard on human rights issues, for example, and some conflict on the issue of welfare. What about something like Europe, the EU referendum? Would the Lib Dems perhaps give way on that if they got concessions on other areas?
Well, it's something that we've been writing about in the FT tomorrow, actually, that that it's fairly clear, talking to a number of senior Liberal Democrats, they realise if, in the event of a hung parliament, David Cameron approached them for another coalition, David Cameron, under any circumstance, would have to deliver a referendum on Europe. Otherwise, the Conservative Party would simply not let him become Prime Minister.
It's sealed in blood, isn't it, for 2017, if he wins?
I mean, he'd be signing his death warrant if he signed any sort of agreement where he ditched that coalition, that referendum commitment. So therefore, the Liberal Democrats say, look, if we had to do a deal with David Cameron, we'd have to give him that referendum. But we'd be in a strong negotiating position. We'd say we want things in return. And people behind the scenes here are talking about the possibility of reviving some kind of Liberal Democrat constitutional package. They weren't very successful in this parliament, of course, in delivering that, but talking about things like, for example, public proportional representation, fair votes, they call it, for local elections, maybe reform of party funding, a long-standing Liberal Democrat interest, maybe returning yet again to reforming the House of Lords. But I think the Liberal Democrats would say, yes, David Cameron, you can have your referendum. We don't think it's a good idea, but you can have it. But we want something quite significant in return.
It's interesting, isn't it, that the tuition fees fiasco still hangs over this party. And presumably they're desperate to avoid any costs, a repeat of that. Do you think there are signs this week of the leadership rowing back from pledges which the party might find difficult to meet in another coalition? I mean, for instance, we heard today they're not talking about a mansion tax anymore, are they? They're talking about a revaluation of high-value properties with additional council tax bans. Not very catchy, but are they trying to water it down or not?
I think that's just a bit of a rebranding exercise. I think they're a bit embarrassed about the tag mansion tax because, as anyone who lives in London knows, £2 million doesn't buy you a mansion. In some parts of London, it buys you a one-bedroom flat. So I think they're embarrassed about that. But I think the council tax model, which Danny Alexander was setting out a couple of months ago, has now been adopted by Labour. And I think most people would see it was probably a question of justice, that why is someone living in a £2 million house paying the same council tax as someone maybe living in a house worth £600,000? So it's been rebranded. But I think you're right. I think in general terms, they want to avoid anything in the manifesto which becomes a hostage to fortune in coalition negotiations in the way that tuition fees did after the 2010 election. One of the big tests, I think, will be how the Liberal Democrats approach the airports question, because there's a party commitment against any further expansion of airports. And we know that shortly after the election, Howard Davis, who's doing this review for the government on airports, will produce a report on where London needs a new runway, either at Heathrow or Gatwick. Now, are the Liberal Democrats going to block that under any circumstances, or are they going to give themselves a bit of wiggle room? I suspect a bit of wiggle room is going to be required.
Yeah, we were getting some hints, weren't we, yesterday about that maybe change of approach on Gatwick. And won't we hear that in a debate this week on Tuesday?
That's right. The leadership has tacitly supporting an amendment which would give them exactly that wiggle room and say, look, because of new technology, meaning that aircraft are quieter and more fuel efficient, and maybe in certain circumstances we might be able to consider potentially building a new runway at Gatwick. So I think that's one area where, again, they've just tried to make sure there's nothing that's written down, sort of nailed to the floor, which they then have to give up in coalition negotiations.
Also on Tuesday, the welfare debate, where they're expected to talk about sealing this idea of scrapping the spare room subsidy, the bedroom tax. But have they spelled out clearly where the money would come from to plug the deficit, as they say they want to, if they're against welfare cuts?
I think they're going to have to do some welfare cuts in any circumstances. They've been railing today against George Osborne's plan to freeze benefits for working age people in the next Parliament. At the moment, they're capping it, I think, at 1% a year. And you can see a compromise there where the Liberal Democrats in coalition would agree to cap it at 1%, so below the rate of inflation, but not an exact freeze. How are they going to plug the deficit if they don't do it on public spending? Well, I think they've been quite upfront that they expect the better off in society to make a contribution through taxation. George Osborne says you can complete the job of deficit reduction by focusing entirely on spending cuts, £12 billion off welfare, £13 billion off day-to-day departmental spending. I think the Liberal Democrats will say that is totally unacceptable. We have to do what we're doing in this Parliament, which is have a mix of tax rises and spending cuts.
George, stay with us. We'll be hearing from you again later in the programme. First, though, the vow, the promise made by the leaders of the UK's main unionist parties just 2 days before the referendum on Scottish independence, that in return for voting no, the Parliament at Holyrood would receive extensive new powers. The morning after the referendum, the Prime Minister announced the creation of a commission under Lord Smith to come up with a package of new powers for the Parliament following discussions with all of Scotland's parties. The public would also have a say. The parties have until this Friday to submit their proposals for further devolution to Scotland. They'll then have until the end of November to reach agreement. The new powers will be in the Queen's speech following next year's general election. That's the plan, anyway. Earlier, I spoke to the commentator and writer on Scottish politics, David Torrance, who began by explaining how the Smith Commission would work.
Well, basically, on the escalated timescale set out, of course, in the closing weeks of the referendum campaign, each of the unionist parties, which have all promised more powers, and indeed the SNP, the Scottish Government, have to submit to Lord Smith by a deadline of the 10th of October what form they want that extra devolution to take. Lord Smith has also invited submissions from other groups prominent in the referendum campaign and indeed members of the public. And by the end of October, again, this is all happening very quickly, he has to come up with proposals which then go out to consultation and result in a command paper by St Andrew's Day.
There are some big differences to sort out, though, aren't there? Particularly over how much of income tax control should be devolved. The Conservatives, the Lib Dems proposals go much further than Labour's.
Yes, we have ended up in a curious place where the Conservatives, historically a party hostile to devolution, have ended up with actually the most coherent and ambitious set of proposals. The Lib Dems, of course, have historically always been committed to home rule or federalism, call it what you will. And Labour, which was once an enthusiastic party of devolution, has come up with the most cautious set of proposals. And indeed, those with long memories will remember that there was quite a change, a downgrading between the interim proposals for more devolution and the final report. And yes, on income tax, the Scottish Labour Party is still clinging on to the idea that some portion has to be set at a UK level. So they're suggesting 75% of the basic rate, and also a rather curious caveat that says that the upper rate and other rates can only go up rather than down. Otherwise, they argue there'll be a race to the bottom. So that's the main point of difference between Labour and the Lib Dems and the Conservatives, who both want income tax devolved in its entirety.
How much of a split is there within the Labour Party at the moment?
Well, this is the thing. There are so many different viewpoints within the Labour Party, and they all derive from the basic reality that if you're a Labour MP from Scotland, you've already seen your status diminished in political terms since the advent of devolution in 1999. And some of them fear it being diminished even further if there is a radical devolution of more powers, particularly income tax, which of course at the moment is the preserve of Westminster.
And there's been the intervention, though, again by Gordon Brown, the former Prime Minister. He's sent an open letter to voters urging them not to support the full devolution of income tax, saying it was a Tory trap.
Yeah.
What's going on there? Because you had the famous vow, didn't you, made by the unionist parties and led by Labour in the week before the referendum on independence. And now, obviously, that's fracturing.
I have a feeling Gordon Brown is simply freelancing. It seems a very curious tack to take. Also a very old-fashioned thing to do, to write a very long letter to your constituents. Very late 19th century, very, very Gordon Brown. But yeah, that has confused a lot of people, including on his own side. Now, I suppose it could be interpreted, and of course it's been accompanied by a call to sign a petition and all of this holding Westminster to their promise. It could be interpreted as merely a tactic to make sure they deliver more powers. But given there is a general sense that that is going to happen, it's not clear what is served by that intervention.
Do you think, David, that the main Westminster parties will be able to agree on workable proposals by Friday? And what is the danger if they don't?
I think they will, because I think there is a realisation in all three parties, even in the Labour Party, which, as I say, has the most divisions over this, that if failure to agree some sort of cross-party deal will be leapt upon by the SNP, and the SNP remain very healthy and very buoyant despite their referendum defeat. And they will say, look, guys, we told you this would happen. We told you this vow of more powers, this escalated timescale wasn't going to happen. And, you know, nudge, nudge, wink, wink, you should have voted yes to secure proper independence, proper home rule. The unionist parties in their slightly fragile post-referendum state realise they can't let that happen. And it's also worth pointing out that most of the legwork has been done on this. The idea that somehow they all cobbled together proposals for more powers in the last few weeks of the referendum campaign doesn't stack up. Each party had a long deliberative process on more powers at the beginning of this year, and all three had published their proposals several months out from the vote.
And you think that Labour will concede on the income tax issue then?
Yes, I think under any scenario they will have to sort of upgrade their offer in that respect. With the quid pro quo that the Conservatives and the Liberal Democrats will accept Labour's proposals on welfare, on certain elements of the welfare programme. So both sides, or all three sides, will be seen to get something from the deal, and they can all present it as a political triumph. But most importantly, they can all present it as a common front, a common endeavour.
And as you talked about the tight timetable, Lord Smith wants agreement by St Andrew's Day on the 30th of November. Obviously, straight after the referendum result, there was that intervention by David Cameron, wasn't there, talking about the issue of English votes for English laws and some confusion over whether the two would have to run in tandem. Is it now clear that the Scottish devolution proposals can go ahead, whatever happens regarding England?
I think it is. And I think in retrospect, they mishandled that. The presentation was quite sloppy. And indeed, you used the word tandem. That was the word the Prime Minister used. But if it brings to mind a tandem bicycle. And of course, if one peddler falls off, so does the other one. And I think subsequently, the indications seem to be, although there are occasionally mixed messages, that whatever happens with the English end of the process, English votes for English laws, which looks doomed to failure, again, predicated on Labour agreeing, which looks unlikely, the Scottish element will go ahead. Because, as I say, all three parties concerned realise the importance of delivering on that.
David Torrance looking ahead to Friday's deadline set by the Smith Commission for the parties in Scotland to deliver their proposals for further powers to the Scottish Parliament. The day before, we've got two by-elections in England, in the Labour-held seat of Heywood and Middleton and the Conservative seat of Clacton. George Parker, political editor of the Financial Times, is still here with me in the conference studio. Let's look at the Clacton by-election first, called, of course, when the sitting Conservative MP Douglas Carswell resigned and defected to UKIP. Last week at the Conservative Party conference, I got the impression that the Conservatives have effectively written the seat off. They think that it's really a UKIP win for the by-election, but they want to try and snatch it back at the general election. Is that how you view it?
I think that's a very fair assessment of it, that it's almost in the political price now that the Tories are going to lose Clacton to UKIP, which will be a big, big moment, the first time UKIP have had a parliamentarian elected at Westminster. But the difference here is that there's another by-election coming up caused by the defection of another Tory MP, Mark Reckless, the MP for Rochester and Strood. Now, that is a totally different kettle of fish. The Conservative Party is determined to fight that one tooth and nail. They'll throw everything at Mark Reckless. And I think that's where they hope to stop the UKIP advance. But as you say, Clacton, I think they've written off.
They really took against Reckless and not Carswell, didn't they, last week? He was absolutely the enemy within or without, as it turned out.
Well, the thing about Douglas Carswell is he was a bit of a lone operator, but seen as a sort of quite a credible figure, intellectual, principled, and not the sort of person it was very easy for the Conservative Party to attack. Mark Reckless, by contrast, seems to be universally reviled by members of his party, and that I'm afraid started not even before he decided to defect to UKIP. And some of the things that the Prime Minister was saying privately at drinks parties around the Conservative Party conference, you couldn't broadcast about Mark Reckless. So they are determined to stop him, and they will throw absolutely everything at that seat.
And UKIP are featuring as well in talk about the Heywood Middleton by-election called due to the death of the Labour MP there, Jim Dobbin. During the Labour conference, we heard some Labour MPs warning privately, didn't we, that UKIP might win this seat. Mm. Is that possible?
Yeah, there was a bit of a flurry around the bars in Manchester at the Labour conference that UKIP seemed to be making ground. But by the end of the week, that seemed to have been stabilised. They were getting canvass returns back. And the Labour Party, by the end of it, seemed to be fairly confident they could hold on to that seat.
But are there general concerns within the Labour Party and, indeed, the Lib Dems here about the UKIP encroachment onto their territory?
Well, there's still a general assumption, which I think is a bit questionable, but a general assumption that the UKIP advance is generally disproportionately bad for the Conservative Party, so therefore better for the Labour Party and the Liberal Democrats. But I think the Labour Party would sort of take UKIP, neglect UKIP at their peril, because UKIP pose a really long, medium-term threat to the Labour Party, because there'll be a number of seats in the north of England, urban areas, where UKIP will come a strong second in the next election, including the by-election in Heywood and Middleton. And they will replace the Liberal Democrats as the challengers to Labour across a huge swathe of the north and the big urban centres of the north. Now, if Labour were to win the next general election next year, with a fragile majority, it'll be UKIP breathing down their necks at the next election. And it's quite possible in those circumstances, you can imagine 40, 50, maybe more UKIP MPs being elected across the north of England.
Let's just take this moment then to look back at the conference season. It's come to an end. What are your impressions as they enter the final straight now into the general election, the parties? Shall we start with Labour? Of course, their conference was straight after the Scottish referendum.
Yeah, the Labour Party blamed mental and physical exhaustion after the Scottish referendum campaign on the fact their conference was so lacklustre. But it wasn't just that it was lacklustre. It was unprofessional. It was disorganised. The media operation was sloppy. The leader's speech was notoriously sloppy, forgetting to mention the deficit and all the rest of it. And didn't feel like a party galvanised for an election campaign in 8 months' time. Extraordinary atmosphere there. And everyone who was there just couldn't quite fathom out exactly what was going on. The Tory party conference by contrast, started with a UKIP defection, a sex scandal. You'd expect them to be the party that was nervous.
Dragged down.
The opposite. It was a polished performance. The media operation was slick.
It seemed to bring them together, didn't it, that defection?
It did. The director's defection brought the party together, and it culminated in David Cameron giving an absolutely first-class conference speech. So I spoke to one diplomat who'd been at both conferences and said, what was the difference between those two conferences? And this diplomat said, at this conference, the Tory conference, people are smiling.
And smiling too at the UKIP conference, weren't they?
Yes, I spent a night in the bar of the Earl of Doncaster pub with my friends from UKIP, and it was a great atmosphere. And to be honest, they are the party who are enjoying themselves more than anyone at the moment. They are the party that, you know, have got the verve, the energy, and they feel that they're in the insurgence and the forces with them.
George Parker from the Financial Times, bringing us to the end of our coverage of the party conferences. Next week, we'll be back in Westminster as MPs prepare to return for what will be an eventful autumn term.
You can download many more BBC Radio 4 programmes for free. Find these at bbc.co.uk/radio4.